So this message did not come easily. It got pushed back a couple of times. Circumstances got in the way, so I'm hoping that that this was the proper time to deliver it. Whether it was proper or not, I guess I'm going to give it anyways. So I can't remember the exact reason why this story kept coming to mind over the last couple of months, but it was something that I had experienced before I got converted. And I'm not exactly I can't remember why we kept bringing it up, but it was really funny after I thought about it. And so Yolanda thought that I should try to give this a little bit for a message, and it kind of developed into something that I wasn't expecting over time. I guess that's how it kind of happens. But I said there was an experience in my past that I thought of recently. At the time, I thought it was an area I was very familiar with, but to my great surprise and shock, I found my failings. Now that I'm a little older and I look back and I have to laugh, because no matter how disappointing this experience was in life, it only has greater challenges down the road. But I learned from my failings and I analyzed what I could remember about it. This was the first time I tried to make a pizza from scratch. I woke up early one morning and I wasn't working at the time, so I had the day to choose something to do. So I decided to make a pizza. I was excited to try because I had not yet tried to make dough. I also thought that the experience after it was done would be better if I waited to eat. I felt like I should have no problem since I spent so much time cooking that learning how to make dough shouldn't be too difficult. So I printed a recipe off from the computer. I read the instructions. Some of the details did not seem that clear about the dough rising and letting the yeast set up, so I decided just to wing it. I mixed the flour together, threw the yeast in, and immediately began to work the dough. I forgot to let the dough rise. I was hungry at this point. A couple hours had gone by already, and I noticed my dough did not seem to rise at all. So I decided to add more flour till I had enough dough to work with. I quickly molded the dough to the pan and began to put the sauce and the toppings on it. It looked like a good pizza on the surface, but the dough did not rise. And I forgot something else that always seemed to make pizza better. I didn't pre-bake the dough. So I had my pizza in the oven. I cooked it till it looked golden brown and the cheese was melted. I couldn't wait to try it. By the time the pizza was finished, the kitchen was a mess. Pans and dishes were everywhere. So I set the pizza on top of some trays I had on the counter. It kind of looked like several unstable pans making a tower. So I started to cut the pizza and I noticed that the dough was kind of hard and the crust did not rise like I had thought. I tried to scrape the pizza from the pan and found that the dough had stuck to the pan and didn't seem like the dough had cooked right. So I was struggling to get it off the pan and my tray started to tip. My scraper finally pried the pizza from the tray, and in a split second, I watched my pizza fly into our garbage can. That was filled with trash. I was not only shocked but disappointed over the entire experience, and to top it off, I hadn't eaten anything. I don't really remember what I did after that. I don't know if I ate or went somewhere to get some food, or if I went back to bed feeling wiped out from the entire event. after thinking about it today, I had hints of pride, depression, and some idea of sacrifice and reward. I also thought that maybe the entire event wouldn't have been so bad if I just simply had someone that could share in the pain and help encourage me. So what I really want to talk about today is discouragement. It will look different for each person at different times in our lives, and the pain that causes it will look different. But if we pay attention to our Lord and realize He has already overcome the world, then we should take great encouragement knowing that whatever challenge we're facing, it's only to prepare us for the next big challenge. And through Christ, we can overcome. Now, going back to my story about pizza, I said that it had the overall appearance of a good-looking pizza, but something under the surface had missed its mark. So I asked myself about the different men that face challenges in the Bible. Does God think of the quality of a man? So I want to look at David, Saul, and Jonathan as three examples for encouragement, discouragement, and quality. Okay, since the timeline of events starts with Saul, I think we'll go with 1 Samuel, starting at verse 17 through 24. I might have missed the chapter number. Hold on. Oh, it's chapter 10. Sorry. Okay. Thereafter, Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah. And he said to the sons of Israel, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought Israel up from Egypt and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the power of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But you today rejected your God who delivers you from all the calamities and your distresses. You have said, 'No, but set a king over us.' Now therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans." Thus Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. Then he brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its families, and the Matrite family was taken. And Saul, the son of Kish, was taken, but when they looked for him, he could not be found. Therefore they inquired further of the Lord, "Has the man come here yet?" So the Lord said, "Behold, he is hiding himself by the baggage." So they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulder upward. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him who the Lord has chosen? Surely there was no one like him among all the people." So all the people shouted and said, "Long live the king." Does any of the children here recognize what quality that this young man was presenting here? Anybody take a guess? David, you have an answer? Yes. And what physical feature did Saul have? Anybody? Yeah, he's taller than most. Taller than me. Turn to 1 Samuel 11, 6 through 11. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. And he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen." Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. And he numbered them in Bezek, and the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. And they said to the messengers who had come, "Thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance." So the messengers went and told the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Then the men of Jabesh said, "Tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you." And it happened the next morning that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it came about that those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. But I didn't realize it, but when I was reading this passage, the next several pages kind of mentions this word, and the word that came to mind was valiant. And I wanted to write the definition of what that actually meant. And valiant meant strong, courageous, possessing or acting with bravery or boldness, heroic feats. And it says it over and over again about Saul. Okay, turn to chapter 13. Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 32 years over Israel. Now Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, in which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash, and in the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. But he sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear," and all Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped in Michmash, each of Bethaven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and pits. Also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead, but as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed trembling. Now he waited 7 days, according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offering." And he offered the burnt offerings, and it came about, as soon as he finished offering the burnt offerings, that behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and greet him. But Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, therefore I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal,' and I have not asked the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." And Samuel said to Saul, You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Now Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were staying in Gibeah of Benjamin, while the Philistines camped at Michmash. And the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned toward Ophrah to the land of Shaul, and another company turned toward Betharon, and another company turned toward the border which overlooks the valley of Zeboim, toward the wilderness. Now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews make swords or spears." So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, the axes, and the hoes. So it came about on the day of the battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan. But they were found with Saul, his son Jonathan, and the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass. What does everybody think about the actions of Saul in this event? Do you think he was presuming too much of his importance?
Make the sacrifice.
Yeah.
I think part of it was just he didn't do exactly the same as that.
Well, didn't...
He was being fearful and impatient.
Fearful and impatient.
But not fear of God, fear of man.
Right. So the thing that stood out to me is this is right when you start to see the pride of Saul start to come out. Doesn't want to admit his failings in that way and starts to make decisions outside of the realms of God's decision making. Let's turn to chapter 15. Leroy, there's a lot of reading. Would you like to read verses 10 through 28, chapter 15?
Samuel said, Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go, utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why, then, did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But from the spoil, the people took sheep and cattle, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. And Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obedience to the voice of the Lord? Surely, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is no less a sin than divination, and stubbornness is like iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, I pray, pardon my sin and return with me so that I may worship the Lord. Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. As Samuel turned to go away, Saul caught hold of the hem of his robe and it tore. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this very day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody recognize something that Saul did to exalt himself of his great accomplishment? Anybody can say. Build a monument, exalting himself for his great accomplishment. Does anybody recognize when Samuel starts to rebuke him, what he says his excuse is for disobeying? He feared his people. Does the king lead the people, or does the people lead the king? Like, so as a result, the kingdom is torn from Saul. So I looked up a couple of definitions. One of them was, vain glory. His pride in one's achievement. I wasn't sure about that definition or not, but it sounds like it fits pretty well. Okay, let's turn to chapter 18, verse 15. When Saul saw that he was talking about David, when Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. Why did why was David such a dread to Saul? What was Saul trying to hold on to? The kingdom. And he saw that David was excelling and achieving in ways that he could not. And the prophecy that, well, I guess the prophecy, the words that Samuel told him were probably becoming much more of a reality to him. Now, I wanted to read all that so we could paint a picture of Saul and some of the qualities that he had. In the beginning, he had quite a lot of good qualities. Wasn't too big in his own eyes. Might have had some humility at first. Maybe the exaltation from the people of him conquering got to his head and kind of gave in to some of those temptations. So now I want to take a look at David. So turn to chapter 16, verses 12 through 23. In some ways, it was kind of easy to point out some of the qualities of David because it was right here, pretty much all listed in these chapters. It said, So he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and handsome appearance. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." Then Samuel took the horn of the oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. And Samuel arose, went to Ramah. Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. Saul's servant then said to him, "Behold now, an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you. Let our Lord now command your servants who are before you. Let them seek a man who is a skillful player on the harp. And it shall come about when the evil spirit from God is on you that he shall play the harp with his hand, and you will be well." Saul said to his servants, "Provide for me now a man who can play well and bring him to me." Then one of the young men answered and said, "Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech, and handsome, and a handsome man, and the Lord is with him." So, does anybody, let's see, do you remember Ephraim? Remember any of the qualities? Could be physical, could be spiritual.
Actually, let me point out something in verse 12. I think you used the word ruddy.
Ruddy.
Ruddy, ruddy.
Yeah.
So in the Greek Septuagint, the actual Greek word, it's a word that means red, color red, right? And then next one after that, beautiful eyes, okay, great. And then it uses the word, this exact same word that in the New Testament, agathos, it's an adjective, it helps describing, and it kind of has to do with like good virtue. And it's the word where the rich young ruler said to Jesus, "Agathos, teacher," right? And he said, "No one is agathos but God."
David, you want to pass mic? It'd probably be good if Dijon or anybody else could hear it.
The way it's rendered a lot of, I haven't looked at the Hebrew yet, but it says it's that he was handsome. There's a huge difference between agathos and handsome. So, but yeah, so in the Greek Septuagint, that I haven't looked at the Hebrew yet, so I'll look at it in a second, but to see what it says. But the Hebrew that that most Bibles, including the King James, are translated is about 700 years after the Greek that I'm looking at, which is around 300, 400, around that time frame. So 1000, 1100 AD is the Hebrew that is basically used for King James and stuff. So, but I haven't looked at it yet, but they're translated as handsome. But in the Greek Septuagint, I'm looking at the Greek, agathos is the exact same word in the New Testament that when the rich young ruler says to Jesus, "Oh, agathos, teacher," you know, blah, blah, blah. And then Jesus says, "No one is agathos but God," right? So it's this good, virtuous, very good, obviously. We could tell by the context. And the text is actually saying that David was that. So I wanted to point that out.
Good qualities, anything? He's handsome. Okay, well, so there was one one that stood out to me, the list that I had was prudent. Prudent in his speech is what it said. He was a musician, a man of valor, handsome man, ruddy with beautiful eyes, humble beginnings, tending to his sheep. Anybody that has read David at all probably knows that that's where he began. But the detail about being prudent, I wasn't sure about the definition, so I looked it up and it said he used his tongue wisely, a quality of a man that has much wisdom is one that can control his tongue. Let's go to chapter 18, 22:23. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. When they told Saul the thing was agreeable to him, and Saul thought, "I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore Saul said to David for a second time, "You may be my son-in-law today." And Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David secretly, saying, 'Behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law.'" So Saul's servant spoke these words to David, but David said, "Is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I am poor, a man lightly esteemed?" Sounds like he accounted Saul very highly and had a level of humility for himself. Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 11. Lots and lots of good qualities for David. I didn't want to leave this detail out because I know there's a lot of people that will like to paint the picture that David had a very good account, but they must remember his failings in this area. And so Daniel. Would you be willing to read this? Chapter 11 in 2 Samuel, verse 1 through 15.
And all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, so she sent and told David and said, "I am with child." Then David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah had come to him, David asked how Joab was doing, and how the people were doing, and how the war prospered. And David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah departed from the king's house, and a gift of food from the king followed him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all his servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. So when they told David, saying, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, Did you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? And Uriah said to David, The ark and it and Israel and Judah are dwelling in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. Then David said to Uriah, Wait here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now when David called him, he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And at evening he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of the Lord. But he did not go down to his house. In the morning it happened that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter, saying, Set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retreat from him, that he may be struck down and die. And so it was, while Joab besieged the city, that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew that there were valiant men. Then the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war, and charged the messenger, saying, When you have finished telling the matters of the war to the king... I'm sorry, I thought I heard 18, but what do you say?
Well, I said 15, but it doesn't matter.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, I read too far.
Anyways, I wanted to at least give account for that. And we were trying to decide... Me and my wife were trying to decide on whether what to kind of say about this situation and what would have led to such a decision. And we kind of thought that idleness was kind of in the picture. You know, he chose not to do what, I guess it was in the season of the time of the kings that were supposed to go to war, but he chose to stay at home. Possibly too much time on his hands, and anyways, the definition of idleness was no employment, inactive, often disconnected. I'm sure this is talking about an engine, but I'm sure it has a similar meaning. It says, so that power is not used for useful work. Anybody recognize any bad qualities in something that David presented here?
How about David? Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that it talks about all these people falling in the battle, and the one that fell the most was David. Because when you look at the character of David over the totality of the text, it talks about David. He was not the type of person to throw somebody under the bus, and he really threw Uriah under the bus there, which was an extremely noble man that had the character of David formerly before David fell like this. He resembled David, his character, and he throws him out.
The part about that decision that really, as I was reading it, maybe it's just not... Maybe it's expressing it exactly as it was, but it almost seemed as though like David did not think at all about doing wrong. Like that, it was like act after act after act. He just went forward instead of stepping backwards. You know. Now there's this baby on the scene that may be coming. Immediately begins to act towards covering it up. And then wants to place the fall on Uriah, and Uriah doesn't. He's the only one that wants to do something honorable and noble in this situation. Doesn't want to go home to be with his wife. He's accounting the pains and the suffering of his fellow soldiers. And
yeah, I think one thing that was noting that for me, I think a lot of people overlooked is he was a Gentile. I mean, it was obviously the convert. Israel, when he was a Gentile, the Hittite, just like Cornelius, was a Roman, a centurion. Like Paul makes a big point in his letters that it's not the DNA, it's not the genealogy of being in Israel that makes you noble. It's how you live your life. So it's,
one point that David followed the sin of Saul. I don't know if that doesn't mind you talking about that, but he followed the sin of Saul. When you went out to battle, the king would lead the way. That's the way you fight. All the kings go first and they fight. Just think if Putin or Biden did that, we wouldn't have any war. Not Putin, just Putin and Ukraine. There'd be no war. The leader's not going to go out. They tell others to go out. That's today. But Saul should have went out first. He was head and shoulders, Goliath, you know, just about David and Goliath, he was head and shoulders, he should have fought Goliath, but he didn't. And he had a wonderful day today to baptism Sarah. She has the fear of God. Some people have the fear of men. Saul had the fear of men. He wanted people to speak well of him. Honor me, he said to Samuel, if we go after the people. And he also had the fear of men. The fear of death. He thought that Goliath would kill. The fear of death and the fear of men, the only thing we should fear, bless you, Sarah, for making a commitment, is the fear of God. Jesus said, don't fear man who can take your body, kill your body, but fear God who can take your body and soul into hell. Praise the Lord.
Well, everybody that has read the account of David obviously knows that David repented, humbled himself, but it did come at a cost. Did come at a price. God, anybody remember what God said to David through the prophet? What would happen to his household? Any volunteers? The sword would not depart from his house. And then finally, because I thought that between Saul and David there was quite a bit of discouragement, it seemed like, and it only seemed appropriate to account for how Jonathan behaved as a good friend to David. So let's go with 1 Samuel, chapter 14, 1 through 23. 1 Samuel, chapter 14, verse 1 through 23. I'm trying to paint the picture for quality of these men. So, David, why don't you hand the mic to Robert?
I didn't raise my hand once.
I'm just volunteering people at this point.
What verses now?
Verse 1 through 23. 1 Samuel chapter 14.
14. Me?
Okay.
All right.
One day, Jonathan, son of Saul,
are you
said
afraid?
To,
yep, I'm like Saul.
Okay. 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 1. One day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah, under the pomegranate tree, that is at Migron. The troops that were with him were about 600 men, along with Ahijah, son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, carrying an ephod. Now the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. In the pass by which Jonathan tried to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on one side and rocky crag on the other. The name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Senna. One crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south in front of Gibeah. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will act for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or saving by few." His armor bearer said to him, "Do all that that is in your mind, all that your mind inclines to do. I am with you. As your mind is, so is mine." Then Jonathan said, "Now we will cross over to those men and will show ourselves to them. If they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place. We will not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands. That will be the sign for us." Keep going to how far, brother?
223.
Okay. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, "Look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." The men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearers, saying, hailed as in, you know, gave saluted them or whatever. Armor bearer saying, "Come up to us and we will show you something." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor bearer followed after him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer. Coming after him, they killed him. In that first slaughter, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed about 20 men within an area of about half a furrow long and an acre of land. There was a panic in the camp in the land in the field. There was a panic in the camp in the field and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. Verse 16. Saul's lookout in Gibeah of Benjamin was watching as the multitude was surging back and forth. Then Saul said to the troops that were with him, Call the rolls and see who has gone from us." In other words, take account number or whatever. "And see who has gone from us." When they had called the roll, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For at that time the ark of God went with the Israelites. While Saul was talking to the priests, and the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more, and Saul said to the priests, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle, and every sword was against the other sword. And so that there was a very great confusion. Now the Hebrews who had previously had been with the Philistines and had gone up with them into the camp turned and joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all of the Israelites who had gone into hiding in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they were running away, they were fleeing, they too followed closely after them in battle. So the Lord gave Israel the victory that day. The battle passed beyond Beth Aven, which I think would mean house of a stone, and the troops with Saul numbered altogether about 10,000 men. The battle spread over the hill country of Ephraim.
So we see our act of bravery, courage of Jonathan starting to come into the picture. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 5. Now it came about, when he had finished speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. And Saul took him that day, and did not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David, because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him, and gave it to David, with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul set him over the men of war, and it was pleasing in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. What do people think about Jonathan's actions? Peter Jr.? What do you think? If you'd have a good friend give you his belt and his armor and all that stuff, what would you think of that friend?
Very nice.
Very nice. He made a covenant with you too. You think he's willing to be faithful? Okay, so I said courage, faithful, honest, generous, honoring, and a faithful friend. Some of the qualities that I had listed for Jonathan. And we're going to skip to discouragement as part of the subject. It says, this was something that made me think of like, let's go to 1 Samuel. Chapter 17, 31 through 33. Okay, it says, when the word which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine. Then Saul said to David, you are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth. Who do you think had more faith in that moment? Was Saul trying to be a little bit discouraging? We ever have those kind of moments in our life where like afraid of the outcome of somebody choosing to do something, and I don't think we recognize how discouraging those kind of moments can be to somebody who's trying to stand up to do something that's right and honest and it might be something that's generously done to somebody who's, you know, not fully aware of the situation, but that didn't seem to stop David, even against a man that had been a warrior from his youth.
But what did David do when he saw Goliath? How did he move?
How did he move?
Yeah, how did he move?
You want to read it?
No. Tell me.
Well, you're bringing it up. Come on.
What did he do, Peter? When he saw Goliath, back fell a few steps. This guy's a giant. I'm a baby. What did he say? What did he do? Samuel, what did he do? Get some stones. Sasha, what did he do? Micah. Did John? He ran at him. He ran towards him. And that's what we have to do. Go ahead. We're going to run towards the devil. Don't be afraid. Okay.
Okay, so we're going to look at 1 Samuel, starting at chapter 19. Now Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now therefore, please, be on guard in the morning, and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. If I find out anything, then I shall tell you. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words, and Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. When there was a war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with the great slaughter, so that they fled before him. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the harp with his hand. And Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence, so that he stuck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. And Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be put to death. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. And Michal took the household idol and laid it on the bed, and put a quilt of goat's hair at its head, and covered it with clothes. When Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, He is sick. And Saul sent messengers to see David, saying, Bring him up to me on his bed, that I may put him to death. When the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was on the bed, with the quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michal, Why have you deceived me like this, and let my enemy go, so that he has escaped? And Michal said to Saul, He said to me, Let me go. Why should I put you to death? Now David fled and escaped, came to Samuel at Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naioth. And it was told Saul, saying, Behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David, but when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying with Samuel standing and presiding over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. And when it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. So Saul sent messengers again, the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah, and came as far as the large well that is in Sekhu, and he asked and said, Where are Samuel and David? And someone said, Behold, they are at Naioth in Ramah. And he proceeded there to Naioth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naioth in Ramah. And he also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? You think David would be a little discouraged at this point? having the king hunt him down. He also is the son-in-law of the king at this point, I believe, right? So, probably makes it a little more complicated as well. I may have gotten these a little out of order, but go back to chapter 18, 7 through 23. And the women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. And he said, They have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day. Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house, while David was playing the harp with his hand, as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped from his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as his commander of a thousand. And he went out and came in before the Lord, or before the people. And David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. Then Saul said to David, Here is my older daughter Merib. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, My hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. But David said to Saul, Who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law? So it came about at that time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel the Meholathite for a wife. Saul's trans. Anyways, the beginning of Saul's transgressions against David, or at least quite a bit of them, started there. Okay. Let's see. So we already read. Right.
Saul 1,000, but David 10,000.
So this next chapter, I would just say, is both encouraging and discouraging. Brother, would you be willing to read chapter 20? First Samuel. David, you want to give him the mic?
The entire chapter.
So I did a lot of reading.
And David fled Naoth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, What have I done? What is mine iniquity? And what is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life? And he said unto him, God forbid that thou shalt not die. Behold, my father. Thou shalt not die. Behold, my father will do nothing, either great or small, but that he will show it me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. And David sware moreover and said, thy father certainly knoweth that I have found grace in thine eyes. And he saith, let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death. Then said Jonathan unto David, whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will even do it for thee. And David said unto Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. If thy father at all miss me, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me, that he might run to Bethlehem, his city. For there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he say thus, it is well, thy servant shall have peace. But if he be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of the Lord with thee. Notwithstanding, if there be in me iniquity, slay me thyself. For why shouldest thou bring me to thy father? And Jonathan said, far be it from thee. For if I knew certainly that evil were determined by my father to come upon thee, then would not I tell it thee? Can I have a different translation? I used to read this all the time, but I just can't read this orally. Like, it's just, has anybody got, anybody have not a King James right now? Okay, thank you. Then David asked, how will I know whether or not your father is angry? Come out to the field with me, Jonathan then replied. And they went out there together. Then Jonathan told David, I promise by the Lord, the God of Israel, that by this time tomorrow or the next day at the latest, I will talk to my father and let you know at once how he feels about you. If he speaks favorably about you, I will let you know. But if he is angry and wants you killed, may the Lord strike me and even kill me if I don't warn you, so you can escape and live. May the Lord be with you as he used to be with my father. And may you treat me with the faithful love of the Lord as long as I live. But if I die, treat my family with this faithful love. Even when the Lord destroys all your enemies from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a solemn pact with David, saying, may the Lord destroy all your enemies. And Jonathan made David reaffirm his vow of friendship again, for Jonathan loved David as he loved himself. Then Jonathan said, tomorrow we celebrate the new moon festival. You will be missed when your place at the table is empty. The day after tomorrow, toward evening, go to the place where you hid before and wait there by the stone pile. And I will come out and shoot three arrows to the side of the stone pile as though I were shooting at a target. Then I will send a boy to bring the arrows back. If you hear me tell him they're on this side, then you will know, as surely as the Lord lives, that all is well, and there is no trouble. But if I tell him, go farther, the arrows are still ahead of you, then it will mean that you must leave immediately, for the Lord is sending you away. And may the Lord make us keep our promises to each other, for he has witnessed them. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon festival began, the king sat down to eat. He sat at his usual place against the wall, with Jonathan sitting opposite him, and Abner beside him. But David's place was empty. Saul didn't say anything about it that day, for he said to himself, something must have made David ceremonially unclean. But when David's place was empty again the next day, Saul asked Jonathan, why hasn't the son of Jesse been here for the meal either yesterday or today? Jonathan replied, David earnestly asked me if he could go to Bethlehem. He said, please let me go, for we are having a family sacrifice. My brother demanded that I be there, so please let me go away to see my brothers. That's why he isn't here at the king's table. Saul boiled with rage at Jonathan. You stupid son of a whore. Dreadful. He swore at him. Do you think I don't know that you want him to be king in your place? Do you not think I don't know that you want him to be king in your place, shaming yourself and your mother? As long as that son of Jesse is alive, you'll never be king. Now go and get him so I can kill him. But why should he be put to death? Jonathan asked his father. What has he done? Then Saul hurled his spear at Jonathan, intending to kill him. So at last Jonathan realized that his father was really determined to kill David. Jonathan left the table in fierce anger and refused to eat on that second day of the festival, for he was crushed by his father's shameful behavior toward David. The next morning, as agreed, Jonathan went out into the field and took a young boy with him to gather his arrows. Start running, he told the boy, so you can find the arrows as I shoot them. So the boy ran, and Jonathan shot an arrow beyond him. When the boy had almost reached the arrow, Jonathan shouted, "The arrow is still ahead of you. Hurry, hurry, don't wait." So the boy quickly gathered up the arrows and ran back to his master. He, of course, suspected nothing. Only Jonathan and David understood the signal. Then Jonathan gave his bow and arrows to the boy and told him to take them back to town. As soon as the boy was gone, David came out from where he had been hiding near the stone pile. Then David bowed three times to Jonathan, with his face to the ground. Both of them were in tears as they embraced each other and said goodbye, especially David. At last, Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn loyalty to each other. In the Lord's name, the Lord is the witness of a bond between us and our children forever." Then David left, and Jonathan returned to the town.
Thank you. I'm sure for anybody that has had to leave father, mother, son, brother, anybody from your households in order to follow God, what an encouraging thing it would have been to have a friend that was helping you to depart, to escape your death, your doom. Before I decided to look into David and Saul and Jonathan, I was going to look into Job, because he seems like the utter epitome of discouragement. But there was one verse that I found just while reading briefly that I thought would fit for this. And it's basically where Job says, friends are no help. Well, it seems like Jonathan was pretty helpful in that situation, but it was Job 6:14, and it just says, he's answering his friends, it says, for the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend. I would say there is much that can be learned from these very important figures, and for me, the friendship between David and Jonathan is special. It is something that can only be had when the love of God is in the picture. So I give our encouragement today. If anybody is in discouragement or needs that good picture of encouragement, I'd say look to David and Jonathan. God bless you all. Many comments have been said already, I'm sure, but you're welcome to say as much as you want.
So agathos is more the idea of virtue, but not always. Sometimes it's just good. And when I looked at the Hebrew, when it's just using the word tov, which just means good, and then it uses a word where it's like in Hebrew, it's like, well, I know they're claiming that this is the appearance, like good appearance. And then I looked closer at the Greek and like, oh, okay. It's agathos, or this horasis is the Greek word that has to do with appearance, or it's related to the root of seeing, and it's like, oh, okay, this is more about good appearance or good, you know, good, yeah, somebody seeing him, and good appearance, in other words. And I think more of that's what it is. So I think in this context, yeah, thank you for pointing that out. I was kind of, yeah, thanks for drawing attention to that, brother. Yeah, I think in this case, it's more probably not so much about virtue, but more about good appearance, probably handsome, probably, so.
Okay, I'm going to get in trouble for this one, but the last verse that you read, Brother Robert, about, well, David and Jonathan, David had a love with Jonathan, was greater than the love with women. seems a homosexual person would like that verse, you know. I'm saying Solomon, or the writer of Ecclesiastes, said, I've looked for 1,000 women, but I haven't found one. Okay? So my contention is, if we have a godly wife, I think that our love for her is just as strong as David's love for Jonathan, even stronger. At that time, there wasn't many godly women around. And you brothers can help me with that. I mean, it's in the scriptures, his love for Jonathan was greater than the love for women. But some of the women they married or they had, they weren't the epitome of the Proverb 31 woman, so to speak. So I think us brothers who are married, if we have a wife that is godly, that our love can be reciprocal, can be greater than the love of David or Jonathan, or just as great. And I stand corrected in that. If anyone wants to jump in.
I'll just see. I'm trying to remember. What was the wife... David had a few wives. But the... Abigail? Was it? I think it was Abigail.
Six or seven wives.
So Abigail, if I'm remembering right, this is the one that was virtuous. She showed it not only when with the husband that got struck down because of his wickedness, because of lack of gratitude or even the lack of hospitality towards David and his men when they were running from Saul. So he struck him down, and then she came to David, and then he took her as his wife. And then even on other occasions, the text doesn't record a whole lot, but she was a woman of character that was married to David. So
better than the love that David had for Jonathan and all.
Well, I don't think the text records any kind of comparison like that, but I know it does say that, which is great. It's awesome it says that, but I'll just mention she seemed to have character. So
yeah, I was one of the things that my thoughts went to when you were talking about the qualities of Saul, and I think it was when you read about him hiding in among the baggage when they wanted to make him king, and I think it was maybe David who said that perhaps, I think that's where, you know, he was showing humility, and I think that may well have been humility, even true humility, but I think it was shallow. I think his humility was very shallow, and if that was real humility, I was just looking up a definition of humility as a modest or low view of one's own importance. He was small in his own eyes, but and it was a kind of humility, I would say, but David had that humility too, as well as a confidence in God. I guess that's what Saul maybe didn't have, was a confidence in God. You could think that David coming forward and, you know, anxious, you know, offering to, I'll take on this giant, like that could look like pride. It could look like he has a high view just on the surface. And I think I'm not sure if what one of his older brothers says wouldn't even have indicated that that would have been what he was thinking. He told him that, you know, your place is taking care of the sheep. What are you doing here? You just came to see the battle. But I think David had a low view of his own importance, but I think he had a lot more confidence in God than Saul did. There's a verse in Romans chapter 12, verse 3. For I say through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. So I think that's what's important, is for us to not think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think, and to put our faith in God I do have some thoughts that I would want to share with you, Brother Robert, about what you said, but I'm not going to share them publicly. I have.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something about your comment, Robert. I never had given it any thought that that would have been anything close to what you're saying. You know, that their relationship had anything like that. I mean, it's...
That's what the homosexuals were saying. That's their thing. Homosexual Christians were saying, David and Jonathan.
I never heard that. I think it had way more to do with truth and righteousness, that Jonathan sided up with David, and that I had to think of pictures from or people from the New Testament that are in my mind kind of similar to some of these figures that were talked about. I think of Saul being similar to Simon the Sorcerer. Saul was in the kingdom. Simon the Sorcerer was baptized into the church, and he seemed to make some havoc in the church, and so did Saul in the kingdom, and the kingdom was taken from him. And I think of David as being similar to Peter, and being a very zealous guy, doing righteousness, yet still making lots of mistakes, but really being willing to do what Peter did and repent and confess his sins, and then out of that seems to come a righteous life that was good and right. So thanks for sharing all those things. God bless.
Yeah, it's just some thoughts I had. Like, I think a lot of times people can tend to, you know, in good intentions, they're trying to understand the text, understand the scriptures, and sometimes oversimplify. When it comes to human character, I think the most vivid rainbow-like picture that reminds us of there's a whole multiplicity or just tons of virtues that somebody can be practicing, but they're not practicing these, right? So it's not like this one-dimensional sort of evil. You know in their heart there's evil. When you see somebody do something good, the Bible warns, especially in the New Testament, about judging what their intentions were for doing that good. So when we see David, it's possible, as Brother Norman pointed out, that there was this puffed up didness in him. Who is David? I think he's going to go like out here and like all the real warriors over here. Like, and who does he think he is? Like, there could have been something bad in his heart, but he was doing something good, right? And then I think the text is clear enough to show that no. There was humility, but there was another virtue that was a zeal for God. How dare this uncircumcised, wicked man stand up against the people of God, the armies of God? And that was a virtue. That, together with being little in his own sight, overpowered that. Because if we as Christians just have, all we have is humility, that's it. No other virtues, just humility. You're never going to do anything for God. And then God's going to come back and say, look, I entrusted you with this minna, and you buried it in the ground. And you just say, you wicked servant. But there's other virtues that need to come into play to go together. And when they combine together, they create something very beautiful, like a rainbow. So.